This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right then, it's time for the only show in the whole world that lets you travel out of the world, spins you around the universe and gets you back home in about half an hour. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. Thank you so much for giving us a listen and a download and a play and a stream. This week, we learn about the biggest, most brutal insect in Asia. We'll also, in quite a niche move, talk to a frog expert all about why climate change is making amphibians ill. And I've got tons of your questions to answer, absolutely tons of them. I'm loving the ones that you've sent to me. So if you've fired over a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly to Apple Podcasts in the last few weeks, there's a good chance that I might say hello and answer one of your questions. That's in a sec. First, let's catch up with one of our favourite geniuses here on the show. This is Professor Hallux.
Hallux's Hydration Help Desk. Call accepted.
Hello, Professor. If water's meant to be good for you, exactly how much water should I be drinking?
Oh, good question. Nanobot, can you help?
Well, a 10-year-old child needs around 2 litres of water every day to replenish what is lost through micturition defecation, exhalation and perspiration.
Or to put it in much simpler terms, you need about 1 big bottle's worth of water to replace what you lose by going to the loo, breathing out and sweating.
That's what I said.
Now, all that water doesn't have to come from drinking. 1/4 of that 2-litre target tends to come from food. There's lots of foods which contain water. From juicy fruits like watermelon that are over 90% made up of the stuff, to foods like eggs, meat and cheese, which all contain some water. But on their own, food just isn't enough.
You still need to drink. Scientists say children between 4 and 8 years old need to drink 4 to 6 glasses of water every day. And children between 9 and 12 should drink 6 to 8 glasses. Each glass should be between 150 and 200 millilitres. If you look on the side of your school water bottle, there might be a measuring scale which shows you how much that is. If it's not, it's about half a regular mug.
That's right, nurse. There may be times, though, when you need to drink more than 6 to 8 glasses of water. Like if it's a very hot day and you've been running about. You'll be losing a lot more water every hour. Similarly, if you've had an upset stomach, you'll have lost more water than usual when you go to the toilet. Eating certain foods, especially salty ones, can dehydrate you more than usual. Don't worry, though. Your body will often give you signs that you need a top-up. But generally speaking, you don't need to drink more than the guidelines suggest. You'll only spend all your time weighing it out again. And if I did that, I'd have less time for inventing. So stick to 4 to 6 glasses if you're under 8, and 6 to 8 if you're older. Pretty simple, huh?
Hallux's Hydration Help Desk, with support from the Children's Health Fund. Find out more at funkidslive.com/hallux.
I've got loads of your science questions to crack through on the show today. If I don't get to yours, I promise it's not because I've forgotten about it. It's because I've not yet found the right answer. I'm going to carry on squirreling away at the laptop through the week. Do squirrels work hard, by the way? I don't know why we say squirreling away. Anyway, I'm working hard all week trying to find an expert to properly explain the answer to your science questions. Sometimes I can do it myself. If you've got a science question that you want answered on the show, you need to leave it for us as a review over on Apple Podcasts. That's what Elizabeth Grace, who is 6 years old, has done. She asks why children, kids, need more sleep than adults. Well, kids need more sleep, Elizabeth, because they've got a lot more growing to do than adults. And sleep is the main time when your bones and your mind grows. Also, it's because kids tend to expend more energy through the day than adults do, charging around at school and all of that, and sleep is the best place to recharge your batteries. Also, hello to Mia, who is 9 years old and has asked why some medicines are given as a tablet, some as a drink, and some through a needle. Now, lots of medicines are given as injections, Mia, for a couple of reasons. One is that the medicines that are injected through a needle, they might be useless as a drink or a tablet, because when they get to your belly, it might be digested by all the enzymes in there. So all the good stuff that's in the medicine might not be able to get through to your blood in the first place. Also, putting it straight into your bloodstream through a needle is quicker at swallowing a tablet. And speed is always important with medicine, so thank you very much for that. And finally, hello to Cool Gibby, who asks, how do fish communicate? Well, Cool Gibby, they communicate through loads of different ways. Fish talk to each other by gesture and motion. That's what happens when you see a huge school of fish all swimming in the same direction. It's because they'll have a leader that signals which way they need to go. Some species, they use electrical pulses and bioluminescence, like fireflies, where they get brighter, and they use that as a signal. And some fish, they even make proper noises. Have a listen to this. Using their bladder, they can make it bigger, and they vibrate it. And doing that helps fish to make clicks and purrs, and that helps them talk to each other. Just amazing. Thank you so much for the question. I didn't know that. It was good to find out. If you've got something sciencey that you want answered, you need to leave it for the show as a review over on Apple Podcasts. Now, there's been a big focus on climate change all over the world at the moment, and rightly so. It's been affecting our forests, our ice caps, our sea level, and also, it turns out, our frogs as well, because they're getting sick. Now, Dr. Stephen Price is on the Fun Kids Science Weekly to tell us more. Hey, Stephen.
Hello.
Now, I know that you've dedicated quite a long time looking into why the frogs are getting sick. Can you quickly tell us about the disease, the virus that makes them ill in the first place?
Yeah, I've been working on this disease, which is caused by a virus called ranavirus, which really just means frog virus. And it's a pretty nasty disease in frogs that's typified by this thing that we call systemic hemorrhaging. And what that means is that the frogs bleed throughout their bodies. And it's something similar to what we've seen over recent years with the human disease caused by the Ebola virus. So it's a pretty gruesome disease, and it kills a lot of animals.
Now, how do they get it in the first place, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, those kind of details we don't really understand very well. So we know that it's possible for the virus to be in the environment, so in the water or the sediment of ponds, but we don't really know how much that contributes compared with frogs touching each other and infecting each other in that way.
Now, here's something which is going to sound like a preposterously ridiculous question, and I don't mean it to be trivial or silly, and if it is, please do shoot me down. If we get sick with a virus, we can cure ourselves using medicines, so we can give it a best go anyway. Is there any way that frogs and amphibians and other animals can get better when they are ill, and as ill as the ranavirus can cause them? Do they use, like plants, more homeopathy kind of things to make them better?
That's something that we know only a little bit about with frogs. So we know that other animals that we've traditionally called cold-blooded animals, so some of them, what that means is that animals that regulate their body temperature by use of their environment rather than a homeostatic system like humans have, where we can regulate our own temperature. So we know that some of these types of animals are able to exhibit something called behavioral fever, which means that they can sit in a hot place, for example, to make their bodies hotter, which will likely help them deal with a viral infection. What we see with this disease is the virus really likes it when it's hot. That's what we've shown in this new research. And there's suggestions in our results that perhaps if frogs are able to keep themselves cool, they might be better able to tolerate the infections. So what we recommended to people is that they create pond environments which are a bit more natural than what we're used to seeing in our garden ponds. So areas of shading, areas of deep water within ponds, and that might allow the frogs to manage their temperature a little bit better and therefore manage their infections.
Now, you're talking about the research that you did. Where did you start with it? How did you begin to see a correlation and a link between rising temperatures and frogs becoming ill?
Well, something that we've known for a long time is that this disease happens in the summertime in the UK. So we see lots of frogs dying, particularly in the south of England, during the summer months. And no one's really known what the reason for that was, because people see frogs more in the summertime anyway. Frogs obviously disappear during the winter to do their own form of hibernation. And so it might just have been a consequence of that, that the frogs are out and about and busy living their lives, and the humans are also out and about busy living their lives. And so they see the frogs dying. But what we've actually shown here is that when the temperatures increase, the virus grows more quickly. It becomes more virulent, which means it kills more frogs and kills them more quickly. And so it's really this relationship with temperature that's been driving this seasonality. So the disease incidents happening in the summer months. And then what we've also done is looked across years. So we looked across 20 years, starting from 1991, and we showed that the rate of outbreaks of disease and also the severity, so the proportion of the frogs in a pond that were dying, both increased as the temperatures increased. So when we had a warm year, then we had more outbreaks and a greater proportion of the frog populations was dying in those warm years than in cooler years.
Now, as a scientist, how do you know when a frog has this disease? I mean, you go into the frogs and you, I presume, take a sample which has this virus in it. But how do you know which frog is presenting like it is infected?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I explained earlier that this disease can be a pretty horrible looking disease where the frogs bleed throughout the whole bodies. So in those cases, if a frog's died because of an infection with this virus, it can be very obvious. They also develop ulceration sometimes, and sometimes they can lose digits, so like their fingers, or even their whole limbs can appear to rot because of this viral disease. And so obviously in those cases, it's very easy to tell. In other cases, they might die and look almost normal or completely normal. And so the way that we would always confirm infection with a virus is using a molecular approach. So we go looking for the viral DNA inside the frog.
Now, we often hear with climate change the devastating effect that losing bees could have on the world. What if we were to lose all the frogs, Stephen? What if they were to all succumb to ranavirus because the temperature keeps getting hotter every single year? We can't stop it. Just imagine that. What would losing frogs do to the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, I can mostly talk about the UK because that's where we're making these predictions that if climate change continues as it is, then the disease will start to happen earlier in the year, maybe start affecting the tadpoles as well as the adult frogs. And if there's no tadpoles to replace the adults, then we could see some of these frog populations disappear very quickly, almost overnight. And so what does that mean on a larger scale for the ecosystem? Well, frogs are really important components of ecosystems because they have this complicated life cycle. They spend part of their life in the water and then part of their life out on land. And because of that, they really link the aquatic habitat of the water and the terrestrial habitat on the land. So they're a really essential way that those two habitat types are linked together. Gardeners love frogs because they're eating some of the things that gardeners see as pests that are eating our plants. And then I think a really important thing for me is that there's frogs everywhere. They're all around us, almost wherever we live. Unless you go and live in Antarctica or the Arctic Circle, you're able to find frogs almost outside your door. And for that reason, they're a really powerful way in which people connect with the natural world. And so most people have really early memories of going out with a net and collecting some tadpoles or collecting some eggs from a pond and then watching those eggs turn into tadpoles, and then the tadpoles metamorphose into frogs, which is a really wonderful thing to watch. One of the craziest things that happens in the natural world. It's a really powerful way that people can feel connected with the natural world, even in a heavily urbanized environment.
Amazing. And as you said earlier on, we can try and stop this, the tide of this disease, just by making ponds at home that have more shading, give the frogs a place to cool off, to chill out as the temperatures get hotter every year. Dr. Stephen Price, thank you so much for telling us more and coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
You're welcome.
On the Fun Kids website this week, there's a brand new series all about the Internet of Things. Technomum is going to be telling us all about how your iPad talks to your car, or your house, or your body. Plus, there's a chance to win a nature kit, an Amazon smart speaker, and loads more. Just visit funkidslive.com on your computer, phone, or tablet.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we look at the most deadly, mean things that are in the universe. And today we're headed to Asia to take a look at a stinging beast. The giant Japanese hornet is exactly what the name suggests. It's the largest hornet in the entire world. It can grow up to 5 centimeters long, which, to be fair, doesn't really sound that big in the scheme of things, but just imagine it. 5 centimeters of this black and yellow striped creature buzzing around. I think it'd be pretty big if it was close to you. The giant Japanese hornet has got 5 eyes on the top of its head, and it's truly devastating to other creatures, particularly bees. Have a listen to this. Once a giant Japanese hornet has found a beehive, it will leave smell markers nearby to let the other hornets know that they need to join it, that they're going to ransack the place. It can slaughter 30,000 bees in just 4 hours. They do it in a gruesome way as well. They feed the bodies to their babies, but they leave the head and the legs behind. Now, for humans, the hornet can be pretty brutal and aggressive if provoked, mainly due to the large amount of venom that they inject into you. It can cause an allergic reaction, kidney failure, and if you're stung a few times by these beasts, you'll need to head to hospital. The giant Japanese hornet is a truly terrifying-looking and properly dangerous flying monster. Let's get a lesson from the smartest school outside of the solar system as we meet Professor Pulsar in Deep Space High.
Deep Space High, spaceports.
Okay, everyone at Deep Space High, I'm ready to transmit my presentation on spaceports. You're gonna love it. Transmitting in 3, 2, 1. Since the early days of spaceflight from Earth, astronauts and objects have been launched using space rockets. You'll know what they look like. Vehicles with very powerful jet engines to escape the pull of gravity and stop them tumbling back down to Earth. As rockets have to carry everything with them, fuel, oxygen for both the engines and astronauts, supplies and command module, they are very big. The Saturn rockets that went to the moon in the 1960s were 363 feet tall. But the all-important command module with the astronauts in was much smaller, only 10 feet tall. Even the more modern Ariane rockets are over 170 feet tall. They're made up of a main stage rocket that burns for just 600 seconds and 2 solid boosters that burn for even less time, just 130 seconds before they fall back to Earth. A good thing about rockets is that they can carry very heavy loads. Payloads of up to 20 tons. The bad thing is that, usually, they can only be used once, even the bits that fall back down to Earth. And with all the fuel they need, they're very expensive indeed. The space shuttle that NASA used until 2011 was designed to be cheaper to operate by being reusable. Whilst it launched vertically like a rocket, it landed like an aeroplane, gliding down to a runway and landing on wheels. It was really successful, and as well as launching satellites, it played an important role in the construction of the International Space Station. The shuttle, though, was still expensive, costing $450 million each mission. And whilst it could be reused, It took up to 6 months before each one was ready to launch again, which is pretty inconvenient if you want to get out there and explore. To get around this problem, space companies have been developing a different type of spacecraft. A space plane. It's basically an aerospace vehicle that operates as an aircraft in Earth's atmosphere and as a spacecraft when in space. Space planes can take off either vertically attached to rockets or horizontally on their own attached to a carrier plane. And however they take off, they return horizontally on a runway, the way a normal aircraft would. The Virgin Galactic is a suborbital space plane. It's not designed to travel into space, but to carry passengers to experience what space flight is like. It launches on a carrier plane called White Knight 2, which carries the space plane into the higher atmosphere from where it begins its space journey. As it doesn't enter orbit around Earth, it requires a lot less energy for propulsion and can use its wings to provide lift for its ascent. Virgin Galactic is designed to carry space tourists rather than deliver new satellites or provide supplies to space stations. Elon Musk's SpaceX program is developing a range of spacecraft and cost-efficient reusable rockets with the goal of sending manned missions to Mars. Rocket reusability is the key breakthrough we need to reduce the cost of access to space and enable people to live on other planets. Now, it's not quite like getting on a bus. The craft will still need weeks or months of repair and maintenance between flights, but it's much cheaper than building a rocket from scratch every time. Another good thing is that they use all sorts of airports, which means we can reuse existing sites rather than having to build new ones. So when the UK gets its first spaceports, you're much more likely to see a horizontal landing rather than vertical. But we'll be finding out more about that in my next instalment. Uh-oh, losing the connection. Catch you next time.
Deep Space High. Spaceports. With support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
It's time to talk about all the science that has been all over your news this week. One of the fastest flowing ice streams in the world has suddenly slammed on the brakes. The Jakobshavn Isbray is one of Greenland's most important glaciers, and it's changed its behaviours recently. It's slowed down. It's famous for its spectacular production of icebergs, and scientists think the change is related to very cold weather a few years ago, which stopped the water flowing. Also, the deepest dive ever in the ocean has found plastic waste on the very bottom of the seafloor. Victor Vescovo descended nearly 7 miles to the deepest place in the sea. It's called the Mariana Trench. He broke a world record in doing so. He spent 4 hours exploring the deep, where he found sea creatures, a plastic bag, and some sweet wrappers, which isn't what we want to hear. And finally, Ben Vidmar, who lives in the brilliantly named Longyearbyen on the island of Svalbard, just north of Norway, is hoping to make his town more sustainable. It's the most northerly human settlement on Earth. It's not a natural place for France. There's no for plants. Sorry, there's no light for 3 months of the year, so they normally have to fly their food in. But Ben is trying to cut down on his carbon emissions. He's built a bright greenhouse and he's growing his own food. And that is it for this week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. If you've got a sciencey question that you really want answered, make sure you leave it as a review for the show over on Apple Podcasts. If that's how you listen to your shows, find us on there. Search Fun Kids Science Weekly, drop us 5 stars, leave your name so I can say hello. There's a little comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question. Also, while you're there, subscribe to the show so we automatically download every week. In fact, wherever you get your podcast from, if that's Apple, maybe it's Google or Spotify, subscribe to us there. We'll automatically download every week. You can also listen to us on the free Fun Kids app. While you're there, you can find all of our brilliant science series. And Fun Kids, we're a kids radio station from the UK. You can listen to us on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app. And as always, over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.